For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. The evacuation zone around Bali's Mount Agung has been widened because of fears there could be a major eruption imminent. The volcano continues to spew dark smoke, ash and fire into the air. Bali's airport is closed and Indonesian authorities have raised the alert to its highest level. Thousands of tourists are stranded on the island with flights not operating. Journalist Jack Hewson is on Bali. He says an eruption could happen any time.
The last time this happened in 1963, similar patterns emerged where it slowly built, then there were minor magmatic eruptions like we've witnessed yesterday, and then there was the big one came. And if that occurs, then we could witness spectacular damage.
Pope Francis is in Myanmar for the first papal visit to a country which is being widely accused of ethnic cleansing. He'll then move on to Bangladesh to meet a group of Rohingya refugees who fled Myanmar amid a crackdown in Rakhine State. Britain's Prince Harry is engaged to American actress Meghan Markle. They'll marry in 2018 and the Queen is said to be delighted. Chechnya's leader Ramzan Kadyrov says he's ready to step down, leaving it for the Kremlin to choose his successor. Mr. Kadyrov made his unexpected statement in an interview with a Russian state broadcaster. Six British soldiers who were arrested by the Indian Coast Guard in 2013 have won an acquittal from a local court and will be released. The six, along with 29 others, were arrested for illegal carrying of arms on an anti-piracy ship close to India's coast. Our India correspondent Neha Punia reports from New Delhi.
After spending 4 years behind bars, six British former soldiers have finally been acquitted. Local media reports claim the judge has ordered all charges against them be dropped and the fines levied on them be repaid. It is, however, possible that authorities could challenge this acquittal in a higher court, so it's unclear if they will be able to leave India soon. Indian officials found 35 guns and almost 6,000 rounds of ammunition on board the ship that these Britons were guarding. India claims the ship didn't have permission to be in its waters. Neha Punia, New Delhi.
Staying in India, and large numbers of farmers are continuing to commit suicide in the state of Maharashtra in western India, despite a loan waiver scheme worth $5 billion. More than 2,400 farmers took their lives in the state in the first 10 months of the year. Rebecca Bundon reports from FSN Mumbai.
Although the state government 5 months ago announced a multi-billion dollar farm loan waiver, a total of 2,414 farmers committed suicide in Maharashtra between January and October this year, new figures reveal. Maharashtra, which is where the city of Mumbai is located, has one of the highest rates of farmer suicides in the country. The state government agreed to write off their loans after protests were staged by farmers in Maharashtra, with suicides often linked to high levels of debt. Rebecca Bundon, Mumbai.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ollie Barrett, and good evening to you. A warm welcome to Monday's programme. Hope you're well. It's the 27th of November 2017. It's a chilly one. It's a wet one in Manchester. What's new? Twitter is open right now. Well, it's open 24/7. But my Twitter account is being monitored. Tweet at Richie Allen Show. Let me know what you're thinking about the news of the day and tonight's guests. More on those in a minute.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Now, listen up. If you've been affected by family court decisions in the UK, and we've talked a lot about this subject on this programme, you do want to listen to Jason Haddon, MBE, in the second hour. Now, he's a barrister, author and broadcaster. Used to do a lot of work with LBC in London. Back in 2015, he published a book about how to get through the family court system. Forced adoption, child stealing by the state. This is massive, of course. We've covered this extensively. Jason Haddon, MBE, joins me in the second hour. And coming up in about 15-20 minutes' time, Rowan Somerville joins the programme. Now, I'm really looking forward to this. One of the best books I've read for a long time is an amazing book called Beat, written by Rowan Somerville. I couldn't be any more sincere in saying that. A fantastic read. And it's all about the aftermath of a suicide bomb which happened in a nightclub in Tel Aviv back in 2001, which killed 22 people, mostly young Israeli revelers out for a night out. Shortly after that, in what appeared to be retribution, an Israeli settler shot a Palestinian chemist in the neck, rendering him brain dead. His family, the family of the brain dead chemist, agreed to donate his heart to a dying Israeli. An amazing sequence of events. Now, Rowan Somerville, his parents, now people will know Rowan from MTV, from The Big Breakfast, from BBC Entertainment. He's written other books as well, of course. His parents were both cardiac surgeons, cardiovascular surgeons. He travelled to the Levant to find out more about this story, to meet with survivors and their families. The result of that very long journey is a book called Beat. It's terrific, and we'll talk about that book with Rowan when he joins the programme this hour. Hope you've had a good weekend then. I hope you're in fine fettle. David's event at Maastricht went off without a hitch. There were some 11th hour attempts to prevent it from going ahead by journalists, incredibly. I'm not going to dwell on this. We've moved on from this. But by journalists, what sort of journalist would lend their name to a campaign to have an event shut down because they don't like that which is being said at it? It's quite extraordinary, really. I was an NUJ member for a few years, and I have to say this. If a colleague of mine tried to have a public speaker censored and shut down, I'd disown him or her, I really would. But look, I'm not getting into that. More on that another day. The television news channels today, the BBC taken over by the announcement that Prince Harry has gotten engaged to a Canadian-born actress. If you watch Suits, you'll know who she is, but you'll probably know who she is anyway. Her name is Meghan Markle. Total coverage of that today, taking precedence over everything else. And when this happens, people wonder, why is that? Is it to kind of force it on people? Is it to keep it relevant in the minds of people, to keep royalty relevant? I think partly, but not wholly. These people, as I've said before, I mean, I'm an Irish guy living in England anyway, full stop, first and foremost, right? So my opinion has to be, you have to put that caveat on it. But they're not some benign tourist attraction, these people, that are kept around for tradition and to bring visitors to the United Kingdom. I don't believe. And I believe in the grand scheme of things, although when you talk about these things, people say, oh, well, look, you can't say that because there's no proof of it. But they're actually higher in the pecking order than your Prime Minister or Chancellor or Foreign Secretary. And I think they have a role to play in this illusion that we live in freedom and we live in democracy. I think they play some role in keeping that illusion alive. And I've said this before at public events. I've said it on commercial radio. Many years ago, I said it on national radio. What do you mean, Richie? What are you talking about? Well, I said, well, look, before a member of parliament takes his or her seat, before they're allowed in, before they're allowed actually sit down, let alone make a comment or have their say in a debate, they must swear by Almighty God that they will be faithful and bear true allegiance to the Queen, her heirs and successors. That's number one. Number two, the Prime Minister meets the Queen every single week of the year with a larger annual visit to Balmoral. No details ever released to the public. Why is the question I would ask? Why is that? It's all very strange. David Cameron famously said that he looked forward to the meetings each week, famously because they helped clear his head, he said. What an odd thing to say. Maybe he was getting his head cleared of the notion that he's running the country, right? Now, I'm not saying that the Queen or Prince Philip is running the country. I'm not saying that at all. But in the global pecking order, the power structure, they're far further up the pecking order, in my opinion, than the likes of David Cameron or Tony Blair. It's an illusion. My opinion, anyway. Amazing story on the front page of the Mirror today. Going to be brief with the old monologue today because I really want to get more time with our guests. Amazing story on the front page of the Mirror. We don't normally spend much time on the tabloids. But the The story alleges that Russian cyber units are spreading false information about flu and measles jabs in the United Kingdom. This is incredible. And the Mirror are saying that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, is believed to want to erode trust in US and European governments. And one of the ways it is alleged they are doing this is that the Russians are apparently spreading lies on social media to destabilize Britain. And one of the ways they're doing that is by promoting stories through alternative health websites, stories which question the efficacy, can't even say it, put your teeth in, the efficacy and the safety of vaccines and other medicines. Chris Phillips is the former counter-terrorism security office chief, and he warned that Russian cyber farms have become a threat to daily life. This is about destabilizing by external forces, he told the Mirror. War is ever changing and becoming much more cyber based. I'll just scroll down there to what it says. Let's have a look. Security services are so concerned over the threat to public health and security that government departments have been ordered to monitor social media and flag up risky articles. Health chiefs have had emergency meetings over the spread fake news over vaccination campaigns. And Public Health England and the Royal College of GPs have repeatedly expressed concern over the amount of made-up health news shared online and on social media sites such as Facebook and Twitter. The widespread circulation of false health news on social networks is not only misleading but also very dangerous, says Public Health England. Now, whether these alternative health websites have, whether their stories about vaccines or any other medicines are true or not, we've discussed at length on this programme over the years. We can park that to one side. But whether the Russians, using cyber armies, are promoting these articles to destabilise the UK, well, there's no proof of that. There's absolutely no proof of it. Those Health Impact News, The Health Ranger, some of these websites and Facebook accounts have millions and millions of followers and have been around for many years. John Rappaport, the famous health journalist in the United States, and others, decent men and women, whether you agree with them or not, they don't need the help of the Russians to reach the audiences they reach. Staggering stuff, this. And again, it must be said, the Mirror offers no proof whatsoever and doesn't challenge the former head of security to provide any evidence that the Russians are doing this. It's all nonsense, really. 13 minutes past the hour. Look, the HPV vaccine scandal in the Republic of Ireland and in Denmark and in Spain, this is becoming known to more and more people through alternative media programmes like this one. Not just this one, but many others. These are the reasons why people are maybe having second thoughts about vaccinations. Right? Rightly or wrongly, that's for you to decide. It's for every individual to decide. But when these stories get out about Gardasil and other problems with vaccinations, you then have maybe the wider public, maybe there is a bit of a hesitancy amongst people, and there's a tendency for people to look again and think twice about vaccinating themselves or vaccinating their children. Extraordinary story in the Telegraph today. Covered this a few weeks ago. Well, Sky News covered this. We covered it. We had a look at it as well. The Telegraph say today, or write today, write even in, writes, it's got to be a Monday, this. I had written down the name of the journalist, but I've lost it. Parents are being urged to vaccinate their super spreader children against the flu in time for Christmas to avoid putting grandparents at risk. Health officials say that without the flu vaccination, youngsters are more likely to contract the virus at nursery or school and spread it at a rapid rate. The NHS warns this could pose a particular risk to the elderly and other vulnerable groups who come into contact with children at family get-togethers over the festive season. They say older people, asthma sufferers, pregnant women and people with heart, liver or lung complaints are vulnerable to flu, which causes around 8,000 deaths a year. But you see, one of the things that we've managed to do on this programme is we've had GPs on, not alternative health practitioners or people that might be shot down because they're interested in homeopathy or whatever. We've had GPs on, real GPs, who say that what happens when you give a lot of very young children the flu vaccination, they begin to shed the virus. So a lot of vaccinated young children present more of a danger to a senior person in terms of passing on the antibodies than a child who isn't vaccinated at all. This is staggering. And this is about the World Health Organization putting enormous pressure on the NHS in the UK, on the health service in Ireland and other health services to meet targets in terms of vaccination uptake. Again, whatever you think about vaccinations, we've gotten into that at great length on this programme in the last 3 years. The Telegraph finishes by saying doctors are appealing for parents to take up the free flu vaccination for children to curb the infection over the Christmas holidays. Now, I mentioned on this programme last year the Hawthorne Medical Clinic in South Manchester. That's where we go occasionally. And last year, the consultant GP there acknowledged to me, having no idea whatsoever, by the way, that I was a journalist or a broadcaster producer, acknowledged to me that they have targets. Each surgery has targets that it must meet in terms of getting rid of or shifting a lot of these vaccinations. Right? We'll leave that for now. And in The Independent today, came across this on davidicke.com, in the UK Independent newspaper today, it is reported that weeks ahead of the expected completion of the United Nations database of companies that operate in Israel's West Bank settlements, Israel and the Trump administration are working feverishly to prevent its publication. So, as we've heard about on this programme before, the UN has compiled a database of companies that are operating in the West Bank settlements. The Israelis and the Americans, in the guise of course, the Netanyahu and Trump administrations, are working hard to prevent this from coming to light. The Independent writes today, while Israel is usually quick to brush off UN criticism, officials say they are taking the so-called blacklist seriously, fearing its publication could have devastating consequences by driving companies away, by deterring others from coming, and prompting investors to dump shares of Israeli firms. Dozens of major Israeli companies, as well as multinationals that do business in Israel, are expected to appear on this list. The Israeli ambassador to the UN, a man called Danny Danon, he told the Associated Press that we, presumably Israel, will do everything we can to ensure that this list doesn't see the light of day. Presumably, they're very worried about BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions supporters. The Independent writes, the international community overwhelmingly considers the settlements built on occupied land claimed by the Palestinians for a future state to be illegal. Israel rejects these claims, citing the land's strategic and religious significance. And we'll leave that one there for now. 18 minutes past the hour. It's time to take a very quick break. When we come back, we've had quite a few tweets already. I'll read one or two tweets and then we'll get our first guest on the programme. Can't wait for you to meet Rowan Somerville. We'll be talking about his brand new and terrific book, Beat. And by the way, Rowan has generously given me 3 copies of the book to give away, which I won't do tonight, strangely, but I will do on Wednesday. Okay, I'll tell you why a little bit later on. Very quick break, back in a couple of minutes. This is your Richie Allen Show on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Tune in radio, davidicke.com. And 2 minutes.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial. It's available now, so read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalize, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at www.creativeimaginings.com.au.
Welcome back to the programme. It is exactly 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Was given a copy some weeks ago of an outstanding book. And you know, we don't do books really on the programme. We don't do book reviews. It's a very rare thing. I read a lot of books, obviously, but we don't do book reviews. But I was given a copy of a book, which we're going to talk about now, by a friend of mine, the actress and journalist Jean Ann Crowley, great friend of ours and a good friend of the programme. She said, "You've got to read this book, Richie. It's a book by a friend of mine," she said, "called Rowan Somerville. It's a book called Beat, and it's about his time in Israel, the Levant, in Ramallah, after a terrorist bomb exploded outside a nightclub on the 1st of June back in 2001 in Tel Aviv, which cost the lives of 22 people, injured many more. Extraordinary thing. Mostly young Israelis killed. The following day, a Palestinian chemist called Mazen Al-Julani was shot in the neck. Apparently, as an act of retribution, tensions were running very high, of course. He was rendered brain dead, as I mentioned earlier. And amazingly, his family agreed to donate his heart to a dying Israeli. Now, Rowan Somerville, formerly of the BBC, Channel 4 Television, MTV, he's written books before, including award-winning books. He travelled to the region to find out more about it. His own parents were surgeons, were heart surgeons, and he wanted to find out what was going on and see for himself this extraordinary story. So he went over there and spent years in the region, speaking with people, travelling the area, conducting interviews. And the result of that is this incredible book, Beat, which I've got in my hand here. And he's generously given us three copies of it, by the way. And later in the week, I'm going to run a competition and give them away. Rowan Somerville, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Thank you, Richie. Can you hear me?
We're hearing it loud and clear, Rowan. Thanks for coming on. I meant every word I said about the book. It's one of the best books I've read for many, many, many a year. Thank you.
That's so kind and lovely to hear, Richie. Thank you. And it's really exciting for me to be on your programme.
Well, listen, I mentioned when we briefly spoke the other day, it reads, and in the press notes, I noted that whoever did the press notes obviously understood the book obviously got the book and appreciated it, because it does read like a thriller. You're straight into June 1st, 2001, and the events around the bomb, which was, of course, exploded by Saeed Hotari. And it puts you right there, Rowan. It puts you right in there. You feel like you can taste, you know, the air. You can smell the air. You can smell the aftershave on the characters, on the men going to this nightclub, the perfume on the women. You're right in the middle of it. It's extraordinary. What drew you to this? When did you first hear about it?
I was in London. I was making documentaries at the time. I was in a tiny little office in a part of Soho, just that in London that's being knocked down now. There were regularly people shooting heroin outside the office in the alleyway. I must have called the ambulance two or three times while I was there to help people. I was sitting in my office and I heard the news about this terrible bomb. Now, at that time, that was during the Second Intifada. That was a huge set of resistance from Palestinian people against what was going on in Israel and the West Bank. So there were lots of bombs at the time. You know how you might feel, or your listeners might feel, when we hear of a bomb in a marketplace in Iraq or in Syria? You know, those are people just like us or our children or our friends, but somehow it doesn't hit us normally. And it may be a self-protection mechanism, but this one hit me. And when I heard, I suppose they were kids waiting outside a nightclub. And, you know, at that time I used to be a DJ playing records, you know, vinyl.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time dancing and standing outside nightclubs. And maybe it was as simple as that, why I identified. But that caught me, the thought of, you know, these 22 young people, because they were mostly teenage girls, because it was girls get in free before midnight. So the boys had let all the girls go in first. And it was teen night, you know, most of these people were under 18. And it just really got me. But then when I heard about the heart transplant the next day between an Israeli Jew and a Palestinian Muslim, where there was a surgeon standing there with the hearts of both in his hands and having this kind of secular epiphany, like a religious experience without the religion, you know, that just hits you hard, where he's going, what the hell does all this mean? You know, because these two hearts are beating. And for me, having grown up in a household where hearts, the human hearts, my mother and father, my mother did specifically children. She lost a lot of patients. There were often bits of human hearts in our family fridge, because when she lost a patient, she really, you know, needed to understand what had happened. I suppose that's what hit me. I thought this was an image that could heal the world.
And it was at that moment then, when you heard about the transplant, you decided, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to investigate this.
Well, it took a little longer than that. I did immediately research the fax number of the surgeon. You know, it was faxes then, if you can imagine that.
Faxes, I remember faxes, yeah.
You know, it was, and I communicated with him straight away. At the time, I was thinking that maybe it would be a documentary, but it was so hard to make documentaries about those things. And it's, you know, it's very hard to fund them. It stayed with me like an obsession. And I remember going after my second novel, I went to my then agent and said, look, this is what I want to do. And her husband had been the foreign correspondent for the Times in Jerusalem. And she had said, look, don't go near it. You know, it's a cauldron of hate, you know, and it's so complex and you'll just get. But I couldn't. It was like an obsession for me and I had to follow it. And so it was, you know, it's been the last 7 years full time, basically.
And when this is beautifully described in the book. I mean, at every stage of the book, I'm thinking, I've never read anything as descriptive and as evocative and emotive of, you know, putting you, the reader, right there. What did you expect to find when you disembarked and you headed off to the region, Rowan? Did you expect to be welcomed? Did you expect that people would willingly talk to you? What were your expectations going over there?
I am, and this is quite annoying to my girlfriend, I'm someone without many expectations. I go with a really, you know, open mind. And first, before I go any further with this, thank you, Richie, for what you're saying, because my whole heart and soul is in that. And when I'm writing those things about the people as they're standing there, I'm trying to do my best for the victims as human beings and their families, and really trying to put life in them so we understand what it means when someone is blown up, you know, when someone is killed, and trying on all sides to inhabit that. But going back to my expectations, I suppose that there was, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I was a bit nervous about flouncing around the West Bank and Ramallah, not being a journalist as I am, you know, not having access to the sort of protective mechanisms that journalists have, being a total loner and just sort of floundering from place to place. I was a bit nervous I'd end up chained to a radiator for 6 months. And as for Israel, I didn't really have a concept of it. I thought I'd be safe. You are sort of safer traveling on an Israeli airline than you are probably crossing a road in your hometown, you know. But I suppose I was a little bit, if I'm completely honest, I think that I had a negative view of Israel, a slightly negative view of Israel, because of hearing about in the news about the way that, you know, the Palestinians were treated. But that changed. I am, as I speak to you now, I can definitely say that I am not anti-Israeli.
It's interesting you say that, because obviously researching today and, you know, having a good look at you and what you've done, you did acknowledge, I mean, I read an interview you did with the Irish Independent, and you did acknowledge that you believed that you were setting out to go to Israel with an open mind. But when you got there, you realised that you had been a bit anti-Israeli before going out, which you've just acknowledged. That's interesting, that, because you do have Jewish blood, don't you, on your mum's side, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, being anti-Israeli and having Jewish blood is not connected.
No, of course not.
You have Jewish people who, you know, are as far away from being Israeli as you or me, for all I know, you know. But on the other hand, I suppose that's it. What I now understand, I mean, as you know, Richie, I'm quite critical of Israel in the book. I hope.
Yes.
I actually restrain my criticism as much as possible and seek balance all the time. I am definitely critical of Israel. And, you know, if it comes when you were mentioning earlier on in the program about sanctions, you know, and how the blacklist is, you know, the Israeli government or whoever within Israel, and no doubt the lobbies in the US are trying really hard to prevent the publication of this blacklist. You know, at the end of the day, the reason they're doing this, I believe, and this is sheer conjecture from me, is that they have an analysis of what happened in South Africa. And the apartheid government in South Africa was brought down by sanctions. You know, we live in a world which is dominated by capitalism, you know, and when business moves, things really move. So if you attack businesses, as happened in South Africa, of course, for the nice liberals like me, we don't like our arts being attacked or, you know, bands not playing there. But it really means not very much. It's when business is threatened. And I think that they have the historical sophistication to see the effects that had on the apartheid government. And so they're going to make damn sure that it's not going to happen again. They'll do it really, really with an intensity, because they know what a threat that is.
My big concern with that is whether people support BDS or whether they don't. Now, I happen to support it, and I never hide behind objectivity. I always say what it is I feel. And you and I had talks about a private conversation about how we see the region, and I'm with you. For me, the answer is a two-state solution. Maybe how that would play out for me might differ to you, but I believe you have Israel and Palestine side by side. But we won't get into any of that tonight.
No, it's
too complex, and we don't have the time for it. But I would agree with people's rights to decide, well, I won't buy an Israeli product. Doesn't mean that I don't support a two-state solution, but I'm not going to buy produce because I disagree with the settlements and I disagree with the human rights violations and everything else. But they are working very hard. When I say they, the Israeli lobby in this country and in Ireland and everywhere else are working hard to try and make that illegal, which worries me.
It's right to be worried by it. I mean, you know what's absolutely insane? I mean, one of the things I did learn, I mean, so, you know, let me, going back to being anti-Israeli, why I'm not anti-Israeli? Because it's about as valid a moral position as being anti-Irish, as being anti-Nigerian. You know, it doesn't help anyone. It's total bollocks. You know, you see a group of 20 school children walk past you in Israel and you want to say, if you're anti-Israeli, then you're anti them. You know, I'm against the injustices that are played out in that country. And many Israelis, if not most, are not part of that, because the bravest resistance to the injustice that goes on in the whole world is going on in Israel. And this makes one of the main problems with sanctions against Israel and boycott, is because the people who will be hit hardest will be the people who are fighting strongest against from within Israel. And yet, for me, when I look at the situation, I don't know that there's any other way. Although the people who are doing their best, you know, the liberals, those people who, within Israel who are fighting for it, are going to suffer the most from boycott. I don't know what else is open, you know, which is why I think I support it here. And when it comes to the closing down of this argument, of course we should be allowed to at least see the list and make up our own mind. And although boycotts would be really mean because so many people will be affected who are innocent in Israel, I don't know what else one can do to affect a positive change. Because one thing's for absolute certain, it's not going to happen from our governments. It's not going to happen from the US government. It's not going to happen because Saudi Arabia is Israel's greatest ally, not the United States, and they're terrified. You know, it's all a complex mishmash. But, you know, so I wonder, of course we should have the choice ourselves to make up our minds, but they are historically aware and they know what happened to apartheid, how it brought the whole shebang down. It wasn't just the ANC, it was the fact that business couldn't function. So the business leaders who control so much get together, and that's when the political situation changes.
I want to take it back to the book, because this segues neatly into what I was going to say next, which is that you can park your opinions on the settlements, on Gaza, on the blockade, on everything else to one side when you're reading the book, because you're dealing with ordinary men and women from two different backgrounds. You're meeting ordinary men and women. And one of the great successes and one of the great triumphs of the book is you get this sense through the conversations you have with so many people, that these people, regardless of what they might or might not believe or what they have done or haven't done, they're ordinary people. They're in this situation, for better or for worse. And that's the triumph of the book, it really is. I wanna ask you about meeting with Saeed Hatari's family, the suicide bomber. That's incredibly powerful, that. And again, brilliantly written. I get the sense you're taking no liberties when you write about that, Rowan. It appears to me that, you know, it was powerful enough without you sensationalising it at all. It was a powerful, very tense moment. Talk to us about meeting the family of the young man, because he was very young. What did you expect when you met them? What did you think you'd be talking about, and what happened?
Well, you know, as I was saying, that I'm not a journalist, and I had this slight insecurity, you know, about not being a journalist, this slight insecurity about being a kind of, you know, a sort of Walter Mitty character, like, what the hell am I doing? No one's commissioned this book, and I'm just wandering into this house which is protected by Hamas, and I don't have anyone helping me. I didn't even have a translator initially, and, you know, I just came by taxi, and so I was full of nervousness, you know. I mean, I'd set up the interview in a highly unconventional manner. Most journalists will use a fixer, you know, who's a professional, who's from that place, who'll organise everything, who'll contact the people, who'll guarantee your safety, and will smooth the whole thing out. But behind this all, and just stop me if I'm going off on a tangent, the whole of the world of terrorism is a world of theatre. And, you know, without the media, a bomb like the bomb that happened outside the nightclub, or the stabbing of people in a restaurant, or the running over of people in a crowded street. Without the media, those things would just be another crime. But with the media, there's a play between the media and those things. It's not that the media are controlled by some evil lizards who want us all to, you know, it's that people are interested in all these things. Now, if you use a fixer to set up the interview as I did, then you are organizing, you know, the people will know what you're coming to do and there'll be a sort of drama to it. So I really wanted to meet the dad of the suicide bomber on a one-to-one basis. So I ended up, because I used to work in television, I used to work on The Big Breakfast, you know, the show, Chris Evans and dad. I was part of, you know, I was a researcher. I was like a dog's body when it started and I was part of the original team that did it. So I really understood live TV. I had connections in TV and I happened through really bizarre, you know, seven distant connections, happened to know someone who worked on the Palestinian version of Sesame Street. And I went to their production meeting, which was held in a bar in the West Bank, where everyone was drinking pints of Tayyab Palestinian lager. And it was a really jolly place. And I went in there and I just asked them for help and they helped organize the whole thing. So have I gone far off your original question?
No, it's terrific. Yeah, the Sesame Street, the Palestinian version of Sesame Street, I'd laughed out loud when I read that in the book.
It was true. I mean, it was going
you
on.
You couldn't make it up, yeah.
They were young, really clever, motivated people who were just so delighted to have a job because actually Sesame Street, the American one, there's a massive non-profit organization where they give Sesame Street and help fund Sesame Street in all over the world, in Bangladesh and, you know, in the Palestinian one. And their rule is that there to be no politics. For instance, they wanted one of the puppets to wear a green outfit. And the Sesame Street people said, no way, no green outfit. That's the color of Palestine. And it's bizarre because it's not bizarre, but in a place like that, to be non-political is to be political because everyone, you know, is struggling against oppression. But anyway, they set up the meeting with Saeed Hotari's father. That's the father of the suicide bomber. And I was really nervous. I wasn't, you know, I thought that the taxi driver who was taking me was really nervous. You know, and I wondered whether, and they seemed quite scary, the people that were waiting for me. And it was just me in a sitting room with these people. And, you know, one of the worst moments was when I got there, I was just hoping he'd speak English. And when I got there, he goes, you know, where's the interpreter? And I hadn't got an interpreter because I didn't know one and I didn't want to spend the money. And I just was hoping, you know, I was just on a wing and a prayer. And then I managed to get one while I was sitting. So I was sitting in a room with him and some scary looking people for about 2 hours. And then this little kid came in, like a 2-year-old, comes out the kitchen. All the women were in the kitchen. They never came out except to bring us tea, you know. And this little 2-3-year-old came and he was bouncing around and being really funny. And the dad, Abu Hotari, which means father of Hotari, you know, he softened up. He was actually the grandfather of the child. He softened up immediately, and the little kid was clearly the king of the household, and he was pulling stuff out my bag, and then I was laughing and going, oh, isn't he nicer? What is his name? His name? And you know, they said, Osama. And I started doing all this fake laughter, thinking they were just taking the piss out of me. And they were standing there going, no, Osama. And so, you know, it was initially very uncomfortable, but I spent many, many hours there. And going back to what you were originally saying, the humanity is what shone through, because at a certain level, an ultimate level, Abu Hotari was someone who'd lost his son. He really didn't know, in my opinion, what his son was about to do, because he would have stopped him. You know, this was a man who had no basis in the armed struggle at all. And his son was not a nutbag, fanatical, religious person, as we were given the impression. In fact, his dad complained to me that previously he was upset that he hadn't been involved in the political struggle. And no one seemed to, you know, the Palestinians, this is a massive generalization, are not, or certainly didn't used to be, people known for their, you know, strict adherence to Islam. I'm sure there are loads now, but it used to be quite a secular place.
That's certainly right. That's very important. Yeah, absolutely. And he was very much into his sports, wasn't he, Saeed Hatari? As you say in the book, there wasn't any inclination that he'd been radicalised or that he was ever going to go down this particular path. Did you get any sense from the father, Rowan, that he in any way condemned what his son had did? Did he condone it? Did he understand it? How do you think, because when you met him, of course, you're talking several years later, I think the best part of more than a decade later when you met him. How did he feel about it then? Was he regretful? Was he how did he feel about it?
It's complex, because actually one thing which I did do was, the meeting in the book is actually two meetings with a few years behind, which I squashed together. But everything that was said, you know, and noted. What he, at first, when I asked him about it, he was very defensive of the justification of doing such a thing. You know, there's a whole culture of him being a shaheed, of him being a martyr. You know, and so the father is known as father of the martyr, and the mother is known as mother of the martyr, and often the street will be known as street where the mother of the martyr lives, you know, and there's a whole culture because and so, you know, that was coming off him, because as well, he's a man who, you know, in the 67 war, you know, ran from his home and lived in refugee camps. You know, his child was brought up in a refugee camp. They were, you know, scrabbling together to make a living in Jordan and other places. And so he had this, you know, powerful sense of, you know, I'm a Palestinian, and he was very aware of oppression and his land being stolen and all, you know, this was very much. And so in some ways, not in some ways, you know, he was defending what his son had done. And I had the hardest bit of all of it for me was that, you know, I've spent, I mean, I'm not saying it's hard for me in comparison to what's going on, but I spent a lot of time speaking to the mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and friends of those 22 young people who've been blown to bits outside the nightclub. These are kids outside there, you know, and on top of which, not that it makes them less or more culpable, but they were actually, they were only recently Israeli. Their parents, they hadn't asked to emigrate to Israel. That had been their parents. And why had their parents done it? The same anyone emigrates, to escape danger or to find a better life for your children and for yourselves. You know, that's what had motivated them. And I have been with those people and seen the terrible result and the grief on such a huge scale. Because remember, 22 victims and 23, including Saeed, the young man who killed himself, they were killed, but there were hundreds injured. And of those 22 killed, there are, you know, about 50 people per person who are directly, you know, affected by it. So it caused so much grief and horror for lifetimes for people. And there was the dad saying, justifying it. So the hardest thing I had to do, or I felt in my naivety, was to say, look, I've spent time with the children of your son killed, you know, the parents, and their parents just like you. And they feel, as you know more than anyone, what it feels like to lose a child. Do you ever give a thought to them?
But that's journalism. That's excellent. It's the only question.
And he went crazy. Oh, not crazy. He just started shouting. And he's a very controlled and intelligent, and I would say decent man. And he was very, very angry with me. And by this time, I'd got this guy to come and translate, who was a beautiful professor who somehow I'd managed to convince to come take an hour's taxi drive and come and translate for me. And he'd refused to translate the question, you know, initially. And he said, no, not a good idea. And I was prodding him and just going, just ask it, just ask it. And you know what? Here was me feeling like I had, that was journalism, that's what I should have done. It was sort of naive and pathetic of me. I was just digging at a bruise, you know.
No, I wouldn't have said that at all. I mean, I've read the passage in the book. No, it's the question that you have to ask. And of course, you know, he's going to come back with, and you do, you know, in fairness to you, talk in the book about the not Operation Protective Edge, the previous one, you talk about it. Dig Me Out of a Hole Here, Owen, the previous Israeli incursion.
Cast lead,
that's right, which cost the lives of 1,500 Palestinians and, you know, a couple of hundred children. So you do that. You're always going to get that answer. And, you know, most, I think, of my audience would be sympathetic to the feelings of the old dad, of the father. And they would say, well, you know, decades of brutal occupation and decades of crimes against humanity, decades of illegal incarceration, and these operations with these Israeli planes, they will say, you know, my audience will say, well, you know, the old man is right, you know. But then we're back to an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind, Rowan, aren't we? And you can reduce it to that, aren't you?
I think that his reaction is understandable, but yeah. I don't believe that he is right. Because if you die for a land or kill someone for a land, who's going to live on that land? It's not the way. Now, you could say justifiable. At what point can you say it's justifiable?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I would never seek to justify that. Never. And I'm an Irish Republican. I'm a man who believes and always was brought up to believe in a united Ireland. But I never had any sympathy with the IRA or any other terrorist or any other murderer ever. Nor would I.
A combination of both, Richard, because yeah. It's just, you know, when we think of like a royal wedding announced today, which I don't care one way or better, no. You know, or another, but I do wish them well because they're young people. But I mean, I'm half English, half Irish, and the Irish part of me is definitely Republican.
Yeah.
So it's a combination. But the English part of me thinks, oh, great, good luck to them all. But going back
Can I ask you this, Rowan, because we've got about 8 or 9 minutes left, and I really do want to talk about the heart transplant. By the way, Rowan Somerville is on the line. The book is Beat, the true story of a suicide bomb and a heart. It's an exceptional read, it really is. And I'm delighted that this week we have three copies of the book to give away, and I'll do that on Wednesday. But we've had similar-ish career paths in terms of the sorts of people we've worked with and where we've been and what we've done. Look, there's no but for me. I'm not going to go back on what I said. Murder and violence is wrong. It is wrong. I never supported the IRA, but I hated the British occupation of the six counties, and I still do, but I never tolerate or support violence. But what I've always believed, and this is in no way to justify what Saeed Hatari did, when the international community ignores what Israel has done, what the Israeli government, not Jewish people, but what the Zionist government of Israel has done to that people, to that beleaguered people in Palestine, for me, when they get away with it and they're not dealt with like any other country would be dealt with, it's not talked about, it's not sorted out. What that young man did outside that nightclub is heinous, but it's inevitable, Rowan.
Well, I don't think it is inevitable, and I'm not the one, you know, if you ask my, I can understand what happened. I really condemn it. I don't see what their options were. I think it's, you know, it's like it's struggle and war. And look, after he'd shouted at me, we went up to the roof of his house, and there was the wall, you know, the massive wall, which is called that euphemism, a separation barrier. It's a huge, great wall for yeah. huge parts of it, the biggest wall I've ever seen. And, you know, it's right there in his face. You know, his grandchildren are 14 kilometers from the sea, and they've never seen the sea. You know, and I think that, you know, then he looked at it and pointed over the wall and he went, that's my land, because a whole bit was cut off. Look, the only answer I can give you, and there's nothing cut and dry when we're talking about justification, is that I met a man called Bashir. And Bashir was a Palestinian who spent 5 years in jail between 16 and 21, sorry, 7 years in jail. From age 16 for throwing a grenade at a jeep full of Israeli military. Bear in mind those what we're calling Israeli military are conscripted soldiers, you know, your sons and daughters, your if you happen to live in Israel. Anyway, it didn't blow up, but he spent 7 years in jail. And during that time, he met an Israeli guard who became his mate, you know, and he realized, Bashir realized that armed struggle, although justifiable, was not the way forward. And he became what's called a combatant for peace. Now, when he got out of jail, everyone was going crazy in his Palestinian West Bank village, you know, so happy to meet him and how he'd, you know, he was a hero and how he'd continue the armed struggle. And he said, no, I don't believe it. There has to be other ways, like, let's say, boycott and sanctions and, you know, awareness that we're doing. And a few years, they were all very disappointed. And a few years later, he had a daughter who was shot through the head by an Israeli military person, accidentally, but now she was dead. And then everyone was convinced that this would drag him over. And when I spoke to him, it was one of the most moving moments in my life. And I've since met him, you know, because even then he refused to use violence because he said it's just not going to work. It's not going to work and it's never worked. And that is the ultimate thing. And, you know, I just can never justify it because I've met the parents, you know, and all on each of those sides, they're just, you know, humans like you and me wanting happiness for their children and for themselves and wanting to avoid pain like all of us. I know that's not very sophisticated, but that's how I feel.
But you were there, you know. I mean, I've never been there. It's unlikely I'd ever be allowed to enter, to be honest, anyway, because of the opinions I've expressed on this program.
No, but Israel, you have to give it its due. Yeah. Israel is not like that. They will let you in. It has one of the highest levels of free speech. Israel has a much higher level of free speech than this country or than the United States.
Well, it's interesting you say that.
No one's going to come and say to me, oh, you're an anti-Semite. They might say you're a bloody idiot. But people, you know, the level of free speech is much, much higher in Israel than it is in this country.
There's a great irony there, though, because the Hasbara program of the Israeli government continues to, you know, cause chaos for various men and women in this country, musicians, academics, public speakers, writers, who, you know, have to bear the brunt of these, you know, groups like Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the Northwest Friends of Israel, who seek to destroy the careers of anybody who questions the behaviour of the Israeli government and the Israeli government's policies. We see that all the time. I could list a dozen academics, musicians, speakers who are putting up with this nonsense all the time. And see, this is the problem, Rowan. I don't doubt you. You've been there. And listen, I know a lot of Jewish men and women in this country. I know you do as well. I know Jewish men and women living in Tel Aviv. But what we have increasingly, and it's getting worse, in my opinion, in this country and in the United States and in Ireland, is we have a very, very powerful lobby that is working incredibly hard to silence critics of Israel by labelling them as anti-Semitic or hate preachers, or in the case of some of the people I've worked with, not just David Icke, but others, Holocaust deniers, which is scandalous. Nobody has ever been on this programme, save for David Duke or one or two others who've said, oh, the Holocaust never happened, and they were challenged, and it was dealt with the way I felt it was appropriate to deal with it. But this is a kind of, for me, not to be, you know, not to exaggerate this is a terrifying reality we have, where you have these very powerful lobbies. And look, one of the things I was going to ask you, and you don't have to go down this road, or whether you do or you don't, but this is a fantastic book. It's one of the most human books I've ever read. It's fair. Yes, it's critical of Israel. It's critical of the occupation. But the book is unbelievably fair, and it's a fantastic read. And yet, you're finding it difficult to get it reviewed, right?
It is true. I mean, so far, I mean, in Ireland, there were amazing reviews. You know, one person said it was, you know, in the Irish Independent. And these aren't people I know or I've ever met, except for the interview. You know, he said it was one of the best releases of 2017 in any genre. And then the person from the Examiner said, you know, one of the best books of the Middle East I've read. But so far in the UK, there has been zero reviews, nothing. And I know it's been in the hands. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's a kind of media conspiracy of this or that. But A, it was incredibly hard to get published in this country, that's the UK, and in the United States. And I have quotations from publishers, you know, saying things like, I'm not quoting exactly now because I'm not looking at it, but saying things like, well, books that are pro-Israel tend to function better for us. Or another person who said, I love the books, but I hated the politics, so it's not for me. You know, there is what you're talking about there in Hasbara, and I don't know if your listeners know, but, you know, it means explaining in Hebrew. But there is a policy where a lot of money goes from lobby groups and some from the Israeli government in order to do exactly what people are saying that the Russians are doing. Influence social media.
Propaganda, let's call it what it is. It's propaganda.
Yeah, it's propaganda, but it's also aggressive propaganda.
Yeah, so dangerous stuff, yeah.
You will be attacked, and if I do, you know, one of the signs that this book is not getting anywhere so far in the UK is that no one is standing up and going, you're an anti-Semite. And let me tell you, the first person who does so in print gets a libel case from me, because there isn't one cell in me that is anti-Semitic. But, you know, I am critical of the Israeli government, and I'm critical of lots of other things, but I'm critical of 100,000 different things in the world. But
do you know what, Rowan? Do you know what? I've never been, and I never will be, a virtue signaler. Never. I can't stand people drawing attention to themselves and talking about themselves. We're an open source platform. You know, we talk to everybody, and I mean everybody. We're lucky MPs come on the program, whether they know about, you know, some of the more strong positions that I personally take on certain issues or not. It doesn't matter. They do. Listeners to the program, to this program, will be annoyed that we're talking about this book and your book, because the listenership to this program would be very much anti the behaviour of the Israeli government. There's no two ways about that.
I think they'd enjoy the book.
Undoubtedly. It's a magnificent read. And this is the point I want to make. This is a book about humanity. It's about human stories. It's about a terrible thing that happened in June 2001. But it's about what happened the following day. It's about the irony, the beauty of humanity. The Palestinian chemist who's dying and his heart is given to an Israeli man who needs it. It's about the day-to-day reality of Israelis and Palestinians, regardless of what you think about the history of that region, what should happen to it in the future, whether you think it should be a one-state solution, whatever. It's a magnificent read. I mean, it really is. And it is a terrible thing that, you know, people would say things like that, oh, if it was a bit more pro-Israel or a bit more whatever. It's an incredibly honest book, and it deserves to be read. And I'm kind of annoyed that it hasn't been reviewed in the UK. I mean, when I went looking for reviews, I saw the Irish reviews, obviously. And like you said, it quite rightly has been given terrific praise by Irish critics and Irish newspapers. But the fact that because you talk about apartheid, which you do, and because you talk about the occupation unfavourably, as you do, but fairly, that it would be kind of, well, don't review this or don't push this book. It's kind of a sign of where we are, Rowan, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous for free speech. Go ahead. Have we momentarily lost Rowan, have we? Rowan, we lost you momentarily. Go ahead there. Sorry, go ahead.
Have you got me?
We have. I was just saying it's dangerous to free speech, and then I left it open for you. Go ahead.
I heard you. I just leave your listeners and anyone to make their own conclusions. I'm not just trying to be coy here. The book hasn't been reviewed. It still might be in the future, you know. I would hope that, that anyone read it. It's not for, you know, you could be during the writing of the book, one of the people who helped me most was a Zionist Orthodox Jew who describes himself as a right-wing Zionist. And he was doing it despite really disliking the opinions in the book, because one of the foundations of the Ashkenazi Jewish culture is the belief in debate. You know, so much of our liberal democracy has come from Ashkenazi Jews, you know, and that's the reality behind this. It's not, I don't know what's stopping the book. now, but something is preventing it. And it's so lovely to hear you. And I've had letters from people, and who knows what will happen in the future. But any resistance to free speech should be fought against.
I'm going to highly recommend that you go to the nearest bookshop or online bookshop and pick up a copy of Beat by Rowan Somerville, published by Lilliput Press. It's a terrific read, folks. It really is. It's as human a book as you'll read in 2017 and beyond. We'll give away some copies of it on Wednesday. I'll talk more about it. We'll have a question on Wednesday. We've got three copies to give away. Beat by Rowan Somerville. It's a must read. Rowan, thanks so much for coming on to speak about it. Great, great book, and good luck with it. And I hope to speak to you again in the future.
It's been so wonderful. It's been an honour. And thank you very much, Richie. I really appreciate it.
The pleasure was ours. Thank you. Rowan Somerville, fantastic read. Beat, get it now on The Richie Allen Show at exactly 5 minutes past the hour. We've got to take a very quick break. When we come back, some of your tweets. And we're going to be talking about the family courts with Jason Haddon, MBE. Busy old show tonight. Back in a minute.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial, it's available now. So read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer. Designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at www.creativeimaginings.com.au.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is The Richie Allen Show in association with davidicke.com.
Pulled in just behind the bridge, he lays her down.
Right, David Bowie on the Richie Allen Show. It's coming up for 10 minutes past of the hour. Welcome back to the programme. A lot of tweets about Rowan Somerville and Beat. We'll get to those a bit later on. To see what other people are tweeting, go to twitter.com where it says search Twitter. Put Richie Allen Show, all one word in, press enter, and you'll see what other people are tweeting there. Now, the family court system and the removal of children from their homes by social services and those families then going through the family courts and in many cases those children being sent into foster care or into adoption. That issue we've discussed at great length on this programme over the last couple of years. We've had a lot of different people on the show talking about it. Ian Josephs, Christopher Booker has been on. We've talked to Emma Ibbitson, Pete Middleton Films, the people who made Traffic. Tens of thousands of children are taken into care each year. And we hear on this show, as you will know if you listen to it regularly, from people who feel beyond aggrieved at having lost their children, their child, to the system, the child taken into foster care for things like risk of future emotional harm. In some cases, we've had mums on the programme whom reported to the police or to the authorities that they believe their husband or their partner had sexually molested one of their children and the child ended up being taken away. You'll know all about this if you're a regular listener to the programme. I'm delighted to welcome Jason Haddon to the programme. Jason is a barrister, author, broadcaster and human rights campaigner. Now, back in 2015, he published a book for people to help them, to guide them through the workings of the family court system. And I am going to tweet out a link to where you can find that book. Recently, Jason was successful in returning a child to her mother under a supervision order when the local authority and the guardian actually wanted to see through a placement order to take the child away. Let's welcome to the programme Jason Haddon, MBE. Jason, thanks for taking the call. How are you?
I'm very well. My pleasure.
You're a gentleman for coming on, Jason. We hear literally from dozens and dozens and dozens of people and a troll through our YouTube channel. For anybody who's new to this issue, we'll see, man and woman after another, people coming on to tell us these horror stories. And naturally enough, me being an old school journalist, we do as best as we can to check out the information we're receiving from people before we let them on the programme. And I've concluded, Jason, and I've never in my life been sensationalist. I know probably most presenters would claim that and most of us would be lying, but I've never done that. My conclusion is there is a national scandal taking place in this country. And it's happening under the noses of the media. It's happening under the noses of most people in the country who don't appear to know that it's going on. People like you, and by the way, Jason got his MBE, by the way, for pro bono work. Congratulations, by the way, mate, for all the work you do for people who can't afford it. It's a wonderful thing. But I feel it's this national scandal. It's going to be something that will break in future years that might be akin to the big scandals that we saw with, in Ireland, with the Magdalene laundries, with the abuse. I think it's huge, Jason. What do you think?
I'm not sure I agree with you, Richie. Let me explain. Social services, local authorities, have an incredibly difficult job to do. And the job they do, and also CAFCAS had this job, and indeed sometimes NIAS had the job, is to protect children. And that's the starting point for all of this, because we want our children, don't we, to be as safe as possible. And the local authority should, I say should, only make an application to the court where there is a risk that a child is suffering or is likely to suffer significant harm. And the courts have, over the last few years, and there was a case of Ray B.S. A couple of years ago, set out protections in place for children, because in most cases children are the most vulnerable in society, aren't they?
They are, but we're coming across cases, and we're coming across hundreds of them, Jason, where people are having children taken away for risk of future emotional harm, because mum might have been in foster care herself or might have been abused. Now, Christopher Booker has written extensively about this.
Yep, I've seen a lot of his stuff.
You've read the stuff. You'll know all about Ian Josephs in France. Ian is a regular guest on this programme.
Yep.
I don't take these guys at face value. I do have that little bit of old school journalism left in me. I look into these cases and I see children being taken away for nothing, Jason.
See, Richie, mistakes always happen in everything we deal with. We know that. But what the court tries to do is make the system as fair as possible. And let me give you some examples of that. And I'm not saying the system's perfect. I don't think I'm saying that for one second. But let me give you some examples. The local authority have to set out a case, and they have to be fair in the way that they set out a case. And their raison d'etre is to protect the child and go through what it says in the law. Then the mother and the father will get legal aid for these cases, where, you know, it's one of those rare areas of law where legal aid is still there to ensure that they get proper representation. The mother and the father gets proper representation. They'll have a solicitor or a barrister represent them throughout the process. And on top of that, there's an independent person, which is somebody who represents the child. That's the guardian. And they will then argue matters. They will look at evidence, not speculation, but evidence, before they become put that before the judge, and the judge will make a determination. So, you know, there are protections in place. I appreciate that there's been recent changes in the last few years, which has an expectation that these cases start and finish within 26 weeks where possible. And I understand that certainly where parents are being tested as to whether their parenting is good enough, and that's the standard. It's not perfect parenting. It's not the best parenting. It's not perhaps royal family parenting. It's good enough care. And they have that opportunity to try and show to the court that they can provide good enough care. Because we have seen, haven't we, Richie, case after case after case, and there was one just a few weeks ago, where children have been left in homes where the parents have not provided good enough care. And as a consequence, these children have either been injured, or in some of the most horrendous cases, these children have died.
Well, we saw that story a couple of weeks back, and you won't be surprised that, having mentioned on social media that you were coming on, I'm getting bombarded with, oh no, you're not getting any abuse, Jason. Don't worry about that. But no, questions and points that people are putting to me. We covered the story, obviously, like everybody else did. Little Elsie Hicks, whose adopted father murdered her, the gay couple. One half of the couple was never there. He was away on business. And again, this is a rather strange and startling story. The mother had drug addiction problems, which is difficult. You know, I can imagine why people would be concerned about somebody with addiction problems looking after a child. But the grandparents, whom were deemed to be fit and proper, clean living, no criminal record, they wanted to look after the child. The child was sent to live with two gay men, same-sex couple. A lot of people have issues with that, but that's for another day. The issues being that there's some sort of social engineering going on. Why wouldn't the judge give the parents to the child to the grandparents to look after? Maybe someday in the future the mother might get over her addiction problems, might be able to look after the child, but the child is dead now. Who makes those decisions, Jason?
Obviously, I can't talk about that specific case.
Of course you can, because you didn't work on it. I understand.
But let's go through some basics. If you have a parent who has any degree of addiction, then that's not necessarily the best person for the child to be with at that time, is it? Because when we deal with people with addictions, they have a whole variety of problems which they need to sort out for themselves. Because children, and this is key here, children who are brought up in homes where there is significant disharmony, be it domestic violence, domestic abuse, or addictions, will suffer themselves from significant emotional harm, which is something, sadly, which lasts for years, if not generations. The local authority and the court will have an obligation to check that any family members are assessed. They undertake either a viability assessment, a connected persons assessment. And if that relative is suitable, then the local authority would very often support, or the guardian would very often support, an application for a special guardianship order, a kind of a situation whereby the child would live with that family relative. And if the family relative takes the view that they have been, there's been a conspiracy or they haven't been treated fairly, then that family relative can themselves make an application to the court to become a party to the proceedings, and can make an application to be considered by the court when the court weighs into consideration all of the relevant parties and all of the relevant decisions for the court to make. The courts do not willingly go into adopting children from family or family members. Adoption is a last resort, and that's clear from the case of Ray B.S. and a whole series of other cases which have come thereafter. Now, I know we hear horror stories, but sometimes we need to look at the evidence of those horror stories rather than just kind of.
But here's the problem, Jason. But here's the problem.
Some of these stories, the headlines change themselves over a few days when further information comes out. And things aren't quite always as black and white as the covers of some of the newspapers might present them.
Well, hang on a second. Here's the problem. The problem is these hearings are held in secret. Now, that must be repugnant to a human rights lawyer like yourself. And I've researched you, Jason. You're one of the good guys. I disagree with the stance you're taking, but you're one of the good guys. I believe that you're genuine. I believe you've earned the rights to be called genuine. How can we call it, how can we say we live in a free, fair and open society when these cases can be held in secret? Aren't these women, mostly women, at least entitled to a jury hearing? At least entitled to a jury hearing, and at least entitled for these hearings to be held in the glare of the media and in the media spotlight so that people can see exactly what's going on?
Well, let me take that in two parts. I think that there should be openness with regard to these proceedings. It's a difficult balancing act, but I think there should be openness as much as possible, because I think it makes it easier for everybody in society to know what's going on in the process. And why shouldn't they be entitled to that? You have to balance that with, obviously, with regard to the parents' rights and the children's rights to some kind of family life and privacy in that regard. I accept that's a balancing act. And I scratch my head sometimes with regard to how that works. Would a jury be any better? Well, in part, some of these cases are dealt with by magistrates. And that's normally three people who are you like you and I, Richie. There's only three rather than 12, but that's an attempt at that, perhaps. I personally take the view that you are dealing and struggling with very serious legal matters. And it's better often, I think, to have these matters dealt with by senior judges who know what they're doing, because I do think we've got a pretty good justice system.
But in most of the cases we come across, and it's not only Christopher Booker even in Sue Reid, it's Lara Prendergast in The Spectator, more and more journalists, thank God, are starting to ask questions about these proceedings.
Because, and I've got no problem with that.
I know you don't, Jason. I know you don't.
I think that's very sensible, and I think that's to be encouraged.
Absolutely. I don't doubt you for a minute. But what we have here is we have judges taking the word of social workers who are often taking the word of somebody else. And before you know it, you know, a care order has been placed on a child. Information is presented to a judge. And, I mean, I looked into this. I couldn't believe 2 years ago this was actually going on. Information is then presented to a judge by social services. A judge looks at that information. The parent in question who's at risk of losing their child is not privy to that, isn't being told what the judge is being told, can't cross-examine that and bring their own witnesses into the proceedings. All of this is done in secret. It's a multi-billion pound industry, right? We're
Richie,
talking billions
really
of pounds.
Richie, it's not really all done in secret.
It is, Jason.
No, I'm sorry, but the vast majority of these, they're not done in secret. Evidence is evidence, and the courts expect to see the best evidence in these cases. The court expects to see that, and there's been some cases in the last couple of years which has clarified that. Case of Ray A and a case of Ray G. It's not for courts and it's not for witnesses to speculate. The court wants to see the best of the evidence. And the parties get, through advocates, an opportunity to test that evidence, through cross-examination, to test that evidence. And that's the job of barristers for all of the parties, to test anybody's evidence in a case.
Let me put something to you. Lara Prendergast. By the way, thanks for coming on, Jason. I really mean that. Jason is one of the good guys, by the way. Most of the time he's dealing with family courts, he's actually working on behalf of a parent.
And I will challenge on behalf of parents when I'm representing them the evidence which is brought against them. And other barristers, brilliant barristers, will do that.
But is it true, Jason?
They read all the papers. They cross-examine people. They prepare thoroughly to represent their clients to the best of their ability.
But let me point out something that's very important. And by the way, again, sincere congratulations for all the pro bono work that you have done and continue to do. I have the utmost admiration for you, particularly at a time when the legal aid budget is being destroyed by this government. I have all the time in the world for you for doing that. But the vast majority of people, they don't have access to Jason Haddon. They don't. They don't. And we've heard stories about, you know, legal representatives working for parents, actually working against them. We might come back to that in a minute. I want to read this to you. Jason Haddon, MBE, live on the line. Delighted to have Jason on. This is from, Jason, I just said her name a second ago. Hang on a second. I'm going to lose it now. It's Lara Prendergast in The Spectator. Have a listen to this. I've been told of routine dishonesty by social workers. In fact, this is Sue Reid, excuse me. I've been told of routine dishonesty by social workers and questionable evidence given by doctors, which has wrongly condemned mothers. Meanwhile, millions of pounds of taxpayers' money has been given to councils to encourage them to meet high government targets on child adoptions. Under New Labour, Blair changed targets in 2000 to raise the number of children being adopted by 50% to 5,400 a year. The annual tally has now reached almost 4,000 in England and Wales, four times higher than in France, which is a similar size population. And in fact, in Europe in general, it's nothing like what's happening in the UK. Do you know what that reads like? And you can criticise the Daily Mail. I mean, look, I've no time for the Mail ordinarily either. But that smacks of an industry giving targets to local authorities. And then, you know, through the work of Ian Josephs and Christopher Booker, we've seen how much money these adoption agencies make. We see how much money the foster care families make. It's a massive industry, Jason. What about that charge that she says about increasingly a deeply secretive system where questionable evidence is being provided by doctors and by social workers? What do you say to that?
Well, let's do with the first thing. Adoptions have actually gone down in the last 2 years. And one of the reasons why adoptions have gone down in the last 2 years is because the courts are very clearly setting out that adoption is the last resort. And by last resort, it means that the child can't be returned to the parents. And very often the courts will look to see what help, again, there's a case of Ray W. which sets this out, what help can be provided to parents to ensure that the child or children continue to remain in their care. And obviously, as I've already mentioned, the courts will investigate which family members, connected persons could look after the children. Sometimes, and I'll put it no higher than this, sometimes when people give their evidence might not be terribly good. But the fact of the matter is that's why you have advocates, that's why you have barristers. And again, these are provided by legal aid to represent those people in those cases. You know, and that's where I've succeeded in cases and other people have succeeded in cases, because when you test the evidence, where you hold the evidence to scrutiny, it doesn't always hold up. And that's why, you know, this system, to a certain extent, and I can hear your criticism, and you and I, Richard, could talk about that for hours. Yes. But, you know, it's the best system we've got. It could be made better. I certainly believe that. I daily believe the system could be made better. But it is where we are.
We have, you mentioned some pretty dreadful cases. And Jason, as somebody who was physically abused when he was younger, you know, I was somebody who could have done with an intervention.
Yeah.
I absolutely understand that as you and I speak tonight, you're further south of me. I'm in the northwest. I know there are children in homes and I know their parents are doing dreadful things to them.
Yeah.
I absolutely know this.
Yep. And that's why there's been more Section 47 which is where the local authority investigate these matters in the last year, and I think ever before, because the local authorities, as you know, are being criticised more and more for their failures to discover what's going on behind closed doors. And the world has moved on since you and I were children, Richie.
And there's an element of truth. Listen, I understand that because of... the baby pee thing was heinous. And obviously people are going to absolutely wet the bed, excuse that, you know, crass saying. When something like that happens, Jesus, we can't allow that happen again. And I understand that some decent people will be overzealous not to be caught out in that situation. And we talked about the violence, and I know there are children getting battered in this country tonight. But what the likes of Sue Reid and Christopher Booker, Joseph and the others are saying, and I think they're right, I don't want to believe they're right, but I believe they're right, is they're saying, look, there are no official targets in Scotland, and the amount of children taken into care is a fraction. What we're seeing here, these horrible... When children have been taken out of their homes, it's... You would like to think it's for the majority reason that they are being battered or sexually abused, but in fact, they're not. They're being taken for future risk of emotional harm. And the targets is incredibly worrying, Jason. And if social workers in this country... And there's a woman called Carol Cooper who worked in social services in Yorkshire. She's alleged, and I don't know why she would say this unless she was being serious, that social workers are getting bonuses. Because you've got to follow the money here.
I've never heard that, and I would be surprised by that.
But why is Booker and Sue Reid and these other journalists, why are they talking about this? They've had whistleblowers come to them and say, look, they are working the targets. They are working on bonus systems. The more children they take into care, the more money they get.
What I see in these cases, Richie, is a sad undercurrent in society where we do have, very, very sadly, children, desperate children who are being abused. Children who are suffering abject neglect, children who are suffering physical violence, emotional, physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. And I do see that very regularly in cases.
Yeah.
And that to anybody is absolutely abhorrent. And those children must be protected, and it's right for local authorities to undertake that level of protection, because the welfare of our children, the most vulnerable in our society, is absolutely paramount, isn't it?
It is, and I couldn't argue with that. I mean, how could I? I mean, listen, you're
that's why I turned it into a question, Richard.
You're the learned one, right? You're the legal man. You're the man who passed the bar. You're the barrister. I'm not blowing smoke up your arse, but I can't argue the legalities. All I can say is what I see. Jason, I've had women on here. A woman on... I don't know if you've ever heard of Traffic. They tried to ban the film here. Emma Ibbitson is a filmmaker. The child was taken away only because somebody made a complaint that they put their own child in a road traffic safety film that they made for a local council. I mean, Jason, that's not the exception. We're hearing so many stories like that. And we say, look, I'm not bloody Aaron Brockovich, neither is Emma Ibbitson, neither is Christopher Booker or Sue Reid. But when you see the money... When you see Barnardo's, when you see the money in this system, and you see tens of thousands of children a year taken into care, so many for the risk of future emotional harm, you have to, I don't mean you, but a guy like me has to say, something is up here, something is very wrong with this system. That's a statement, not a question. Go ahead.
No. We can go on about this. I do a lot of these cases, and sadly you are dealing... in situations whereby these are a lot of children who are suffering a variety of forms of abuse. And I've got sympathy for everybody involved within the process. It must be one of the worst jobs you can imagine to be a social worker. I think it must be one of the hardest jobs to see what is happening. And local authorities, from my experience, and sometimes, Richie, you could criticise the other side of this, but local authorities who are resource-strapped, let's be very clear about this, have very difficult decisions and choices to make with regard to which cases to bring court proceedings against. And sometimes there's children who you might think that the local authority should have taken greater action, quicker.
And you know, in some of the cases that you've come across, I have no doubt that would be true. And I've seen some startling things. And you know, when we do this, I will get emails tomorrow from people who are social workers, and they won't be happy with hearing me make generalisations about their job. And I'm not trying to make generalisations. We've only got Jason for about 3 more minutes. Just a couple of things, Jason.
Okay.
We understand, again, I'm not making the numbers up, that 10,000 children leave of their own volition. So this is obviously mid-teenage children, later teenage children, leave foster care a year and they basically go off the radar. That's got to be very concerning, that.
Oh, yes, it has, completely. And this I will agree. I don't think that foster carers probably get enough support. I don't think children in care get enough support. And these are children who are sometimes dropped with a family, and this is their new family, be it for a short term or a long term. And I don't think the support, where we notice it most, Richie, and I know this is something which people have only been speaking about, it seems, in the last couple or last few years, is the lack of resources to children with mental health problems. And children get mental health problems, I have no doubt, arising from the type of harm which they have suffered. And a lot of that harm is physical, but much more of it is emotional harm. And these children, I think, are in a horrendous situation where the resources simply aren't there. And the government, whichever colour, must do a lot more for children in care to ensure that these children have a future, a proper future going forward.
I would agree.
And they need mental health support and encouragement and resources.
Why don't we spend some money, Jason? Why don't we spend some money? You know, emotional harm is
very... I would if I could.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Look, we could... Again, we could do a whole programme on the recent budget and everything that's wrong with it. Look, this whole area of emotional harm is very dangerous. For me, it's very dangerous. It's very Orwellian for somebody to say, I think you are a risk in terms of you represent a safeguarding risk to that child for emotional harm. Let me put this to you finally. Why don't we spend money, rather than spend all of this money, because it costs a fortune, and a lot of people are getting very rich when children are taken into care, like it or lump it, that's my opinion anyway. So why don't we spend some of that money, Jason? Where we see a mum, we think she might be vulnerable. Why don't we spend some money helping her out and helping her stay with her child?
Oh, I completely agree that there should be support put in place, and I often argue for local authorities to ensure that they put support in place for mums or fathers, it doesn't matter to me which one it is, so that they can have the support they need, because they do need that. But something I will disagree with you with, when we talk about emotional harm, Richie, you can actually see a difference in the way in which a child's brain develops from a child who is brought up in a happy home and a child who is emotionally abused. You know, the brain changes, and there's studies with regard to that which show that emotional harm is a significant harm for children.
Jason, just finally, can you give me an example of what might constitute emotional harm? What would be emotional harm? What sort of behaviour could be emotionally harmful to a child?
What can be emotionally harmful for a child is being brought up in an environment where the parents are shouting and screaming at one another, where the parents are having violent rows with one another, and the child might be in the property. Now, I'm giving you that one as a quite a clear and easy one to understand, but that can be emotional harm. If you are a child in a household and you can't breathe because your parents are shouting and screaming at one another, if you're a child who's walking on eggshells because that's the way you've been brought up in your life, that's emotional harm. It's emotional harm because it affects who you are and who you're trying to be, not just at home, but at school. And there are children, and I can talk about children, as I'm sure you can, Richie, who have been brought up in those circumstances, either recently or 10 or 20 years ago. But these things affect you not just now, but they affect you for years and years and years. And I think also, and we're not talking about private law disputes between mums and dads in this interview, but I think that affects how you parent your child or children going forward very often.
What if I was to say to you that again, I probably don't have any right to say this, but I'm guessing, but I'm going to go with it, that if we were to take children away from a house where the parents are shouting at one another and arguing, and maybe those arguments are strong and they're, you know, they might swear at one another, they might be abusive. If we were to do that, we might be taking millions of children into care tonight.
But my starting point, Richie, would be to try and help those parents improve their relationship or leave that relationship if necessary. If necessary, my view is, you know, you work at these things, so you try and make your relationships better. But it can't be in the child's best interest, can it, to be in a home when they can't actually breathe because they're terrified?
I agree with you, but how do you...
And that's why so many children, as you know, ring organisations such as Childline for advice, help and support.
I'm going to remind our listeners, Jason's book, if this is an issue that's affecting you, please God it isn't, but if it is, go to any good online retailer, check out How to Represent Yourself in the Family Court, A Guide to Understanding and Resolving Family Disputes. I think it's a must read if you're affected by these issues. Jason, I'm going to say one thing and then I'm giving you the final word and then I'm letting you go. And thanks and thanks for your time, by the way, tonight. I really mean that. Hugely interesting. I really believe we're in a very serious spot, in a bad spot as a society. If we're allowing people, outsiders, whether they be social workers or neighbours, you know, we have this named person thing in Scotland, which I think is absolutely ridiculous, where people can say, there's shouting going on in that house. That's not a good environment to be in. I'm worried about that child. That turns into a report and then there's an intervention. I think that is a slippery slope. I think we're already on it. I think that's Orwellian by its very nature. I don't think we should ever be taking people out for risk of emotional harm. Children at risk of sexual abuse or physical harm, deal with it immediately. Emotional harm or anything else, I don't think we should be doing that. Final word to you and thanks for coming on.
It's been my pleasure. I think you really need to think about what you're doing to your children. And I think that it is a significant thing where children suffer emotional harm. There are scientific evidence which shows that children grow, their craniums grow differently as a result of emotional harm. And that's why these things matter. But I would reiterate that the vast majority of local authorities, if not all of them, work or attempt to work with parents in situations such as you've described to give them help and support rather than to run off to the court and make an application for an interim care order or emergency care order.
Jason, thanks for coming on. How to Represent Yourself in the Family Court, A Guide to Understanding and Resolving Family Disputes is available. Jason Haddon, MBE. Gentlemen, thank you. Really good. That was Jason Haddon live on the line to us there this evening from London. Now, I made the point, I disagree with Jason, I made the point several times during that conversation. I wanted to invite Jason on because he's worked with families and he successfully prevented children being taken into care by local authorities by advocating on behalf of those parents. But I made the point, whistleblowers have come forward to say that there is a financial incentive in local authorities, or at least some local authorities anyway, for social workers to get involved and to recommend that there is an intervention order that a child is taken into care. That's unbelievable. Children are being taken out of their homes, as we've heard on this programme, for future risk of emotional harm and for other very, very, very tenuous and very spurious reasons. That was Jason Haddon, MBE. Going to take a very quick break. Back in a minute with more on your Richie Allen Show for Monday, the 27th of November 2017.
Book launches are often hyped. Then you open the first page and... But David Icke's new book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told, really will astonish you. Thought-provoking and controversial. It's available now, so read a real page-turner. Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told by former footballer and presenter David Icke. Available exclusively at davidicke.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a
smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalize, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imaginings may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Complete your 100% online course at www.creativeimaginings.com.au.
The future Mrs. Allen and I have had a couple of periods over the last 15 years, a couple of difficult times, financially difficult times. And I'm always mindful when you speak about financial difficulties, I'm mindful that what you might think are financial difficulties might be nothing. You know, to somebody else who might be absolutely on their last legs in terms of their finances, you know. But we've had a couple of times over the years when things were very bleak for us, you know, money-wise. And very, very bleak. You know, and I'm very emotional. I suppose I'm typical of where I come from in terms of my family. I won't say hysterical, but histrionics and me kind of go hand in hand. You know, I'm a shouter when I get agitated. Now, when I say I'm a shouter, you know, it's a very rare thing. I'm not going around on a day-by-day basis shouting. I'm not. But when things get difficult, I emote verbally. And Caroline and myself had arguments during those times. And those arguments would have been heated. And I wonder, speaking with Jason Haddon, MBE there, how many people are being told they risk harming their child or their children emotionally because of their arguments? How many of those people haven't got a pot to piss in and can't make their rent, can't make their grocery list that week, can't put food on the table? How many parents are approaching this ridiculous fucking time that we call Christmas, which I hate? I've hated ever since I was a child. I can't fucking stand it. How many people are dreading that? How many people are at their lowest ebb because they can't compete? They can't buy the clothes. They can't buy the PlayStation 4 or the latest Fitbit watch or whatever the fuck it is. How many parents, I'm getting mad thinking about this. How many parents are going into December absolutely dreading it? Losing sleep because they've got nothing. How many of those parents are arguing with one another, are fighting with one another, are screaming at one another because they don't know what else to fucking do? What do you do when you've got nothing? You don't know where the next 5 quid is coming. You don't know whether your landlord is going to get some sort of injunction or he's going to go to the, you know, to his solicitor and you're going to be served with an eviction notice. How many people are living with that? How many people can say that under those circumstances they'd remain totally calm and at every moment of the day they would be aware of the impact their emotional state is having on their children? How many people could do that? This is not Michael Landon, Highway to Heaven, mother. You know what I mean? How many people could say, yeah, I would just breathe through it. I would keep my calm. I've known poverty. Grew up in Ballybeg in Waterford City, you know, at a time when Waterford Crystal was on strike and the workers were getting £25 a week strike pay and we had nothing. Nothing. I remember that. I remember it as an adult, not knowing where the next gig was going to come from. Could I say that if there was a child, and we don't have any children, that I would have been able to temper those very rare, but sometimes very intense arguments that I had with the wonderful future Mrs. Allen? No, I couldn't. And the idea that some fuckwit would say, you're placing your child at the risk, there's a safeguarding issue because your behaviour is emotionally harming your child, is madness. I'm not putting up with that. I'm not living in a world like that, where social workers playing God, possibly because they're on some sort of bonus schedule, can go looking for reasons to report families, particularly poor people, because poor people can't fight back. Jason Haddon, whom I spoke with earlier on, is the real deal. He defends parents and he does shitloads of pro bono work for people, and he doesn't sing about it, and he does. But the vast majority of people don't have access to Jason Haddon. They don't. They have access to shit legal aid solicitors who couldn't give a damn. You're just one more case that I've got to get through today. And I'm not going to challenge the evidence that the social workers have given covertly to the judge. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to recommend that you comply. Because if you comply, my day is easier. This is the reality of it. You know? This is the reality. It's hard. It must be so hard for people. We're going into this Christmas, Caroline and myself, and we don't have too much to worry about. We have a few bob. Caroline's got a good job. You know, I don't do too bad on the Richie Allen Show. I'm not going to become a millionaire, far from it, or anything like it. I would earn more if I was in commercial radio again. Of course I would. But we do all right. We don't have to worry about that. But I think we're increasingly a rarity. I think the majority of people are terrified of what's coming next. What happens? Relationships start to break down. Tension, strain starts to hit relationships. Arguments, shouting, the occasional glass being thrown at a wall or expletives being shouted. And what does that mean? That social services can come in and say, oh, we're not having this emotional harm. Imagine the irony of that. The very system which squeezes the life out of people, which fucking destroys people's lives in the Hunger Games society, can then say your emotional state as a result of what we do is causing future emotional harm to your child, so we're going to take your child as well. Happy fucking Christmas, eh? There you go. Yeah. Unbelievable. I had a tweet from Helen Crosby. Sorry about the swearing there. There's no need for it. Genuinely no need for it. Helen Crosby. Richie, emotional harm is much more severe than we realise. As somebody who was emotionally abused by narcissistic parents as a child, I can state the long-term ramifications to your well-being are catastrophic, but it can be very difficult to identify. Helen, send me a private message and let me know how that manifested itself. How did they emotionally harm you? What sort of things were they doing? Thanks to Catherine for tweeting the article in the Telegraph about the adoption targets. This is what Jason, I think, understands but didn't want to get into. Tony Blair brought in adoption targets. Think about that. Oh Jesus, there's no room for corruption then. Adoption targets. Thousands to the adoption agencies per child. Thousands. Thousands. tens of thousands to the legal people, £500 a week to the Foster family. It's a fucking gold rush, like California. It's prospecting and it's children. That's what it is. There are good guys like Jason Haddon, but all they're doing is trying to plug the dam. Plug the dam is all they're trying to do. You know what I mean? And he's right, there are kids going to bed tonight after having the shit knocked out of them. I used to be that kid. I had it on a daily basis. I had it on a nightly basis. I could have done with somebody saying, Jesus, that's not right, that. I could have done with a primary school teacher or a soccer coach or a Gaelic football coach saying, this isn't right, we better do something about that. But it didn't happen. I'm kind of glad it didn't happen looking back. It made me the man I am. I couldn't give a shit anymore. Dealt with it long and ever ago. But that's not the majority case in this country. That's not the rule, if you understand. The kids being taken or having the shite knocked out of them. No, they're not. Or being sexually abused. No, they're not. Poor mums who themselves have had difficulties, who mightn't have very much money, might be struggling. It's this is the norm. These are the cases. Thanks, Helen, for that tweet, by the way. I've ranted enough. I think I'll get out now and leave you and love you. This is a weird week, by the way. I'm not with you tomorrow, Tuesday, but I am with you Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I've got an appointment tomorrow out of town. I'm going to be away. I won't be back in time for the programme. So I'd forgotten all about it till this morning, actually. I'm away tomorrow, but I'm back with you Wednesday, Thursday and Friday this week, okay, to make up for tomorrow. So next time you and I talk will be Wednesday, and that's Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time. Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time. Big shout out to Jason Haddon, MBE, and thanks to Rowan Somerville. And his book, Beat, by the way, is a wonderful, wonderful read. Check it out. And on Wednesday, I've got 3 copies if to give away even. I'll do a competition on Wednesday. Until Wednesday, bye now. See you then. Bye.